My fourth significant relationship, part two. Now that I had finally understood what my life was about, it made sense to me why I had to be in Debbie's life again. But this time it was different, as I now knew what challenges Debbie was facing and how I could play a role to try and help her. I had decided I would do whatever I could so that I would have to be more tolerant, more flexible, and more understanding. I was totally committed to making a success of my role, but before that could really start, I had a lot of loose ends to tie up at home. There were significant implications resulting from my gut decision to be part of Debbie's life again. Gloria and her two boys were living in my house. She had no financial resources and her work was not financially rewarding. And worse, Brad, her ex-husband, was not paying his maintenance obligations. Doing what I felt I had to do pained me, as it really had a huge impact on Gloria. I felt that, as I had made my choice, I had to live with the consequences. I decided to give Gloria enough money to rent an apartment, as well as a little extra for a period of 6 months. A few months earlier, I had opened a savings account for her, so I transferred a fixed amount into her account for the next 6 months. I also arranged and paid for a furniture removal service to help them move. One of the first things I did with Debbie was to sit down and explain what I had now learned and understood. I insisted that her mother was present, as I did not want anyone to misinterpret or misunderstand what I said. At times, Debbie was prone to overreacting and becoming emotional, with the result that she did not always understand things. Pat was more level-headed and mature and more able to communicate with Debbie than anyone else. I explained to her what had happened in the bathroom with Gloria that Monday morning, how I had learned about my life and what my role had been in their lives. I told her that she'd had to learn the lesson of rejection, and she had a very important choice to make, whether she wanted to learn that lesson with me in her life or with someone else. Either way, she had to learn the lesson to progress. If she failed to learn it this time round, then she would have to repeat the lesson, and the consequences would be worse each time until the lesson was finally learned. The benefit of trying with me was that I now understood her challenge and her behavior, unlike before. I also understood the importance of karma, and I had no intention of creating any negative karma for myself. I said I would assist her in every way I could, but I insisted that she see a professional counselor to help her with her emotional issues. One of the most important things that I said to her was, "I don't know whether I will be part of your life for 3 months, 3 years, or forever, but that is not important. What is important is that you deal with the issues and learn the lessons that you have to. It may even turn out that once you've done this successfully, you might not want or need me in your life, and you choose to move on without me." Debbie made her choice. She decided to continue on her journey with me. I also explained that I was going to help Gloria financially and that I would like her to remain a part of my life as she was my spiritual partner. In my mind, it was never a case of Gloria and I having been together in any other way. She taught me so much, and I knew that we could have a purely spiritual relationship. Debbie was not prepared to accept this. She was too jealous and too insecure at the time. I really loved Debbie and wanted to be with her, but for me, I was not concerned about living happily ever after. Of course, I wanted to be happy like everyone else, but something had changed in me after my awakening, and I was more concerned about trying to help Debbie than my own emotions and life. In a way, I was excited, because I finally felt a real purpose in my life, which was to help other people. What I'd also learned from Lawrence's tapes, as well as from our discussions, was that there were two parts to my journey. He had said that the next part was going to take place within a period of about 8 years from the time I saw him, and that it was going to be something of a humanitarian nature. He wasn't sure what exactly it was going to be, but it was to help greater mankind. Perhaps being back with Debbie with my new purpose was the start of it. Fortunately, Gloria managed to find a place fairly quickly. A close friend of hers had rented an apartment which she furnished while she'd been experiencing marriage difficulties. She and her husband managed to resolve their problems at this very time, but she still had 6 months left on the lease. The timing was perfect. Isn't it always when God is in charge and we accept this? Gloria was happy with the apartment and they settled in quickly. I went to visit her once or twice, but Debbie got very upset about it. I was not going to lie, not even a white lie, as this karma stuff had really scared me. So I told her the truth. She asked me not to see her or speak to her again, which didn't go down well with me, but I was committed to helping Debbie, so I agreed. But only after I was given an opportunity to explain it to Gloria. I spoke to Gloria about it, and as always, she understood and accepted that our contact was over. Life with Debbie again did not start off smoothly. It was never going to be plain sailing. I knew this before I went back, so I was not surprised. She was still struggling to deal with her hurt, or as she liked to put it, "When I caught you in bed with another woman." She really made it seem that I had cheated on her, and as much as I tried to explain that I had been entitled to see someone else, as she had broken up with me, she never saw it that way. In fact, she had also dated other men and had slept with at least one of them, if not more, while I was with Gloria. But that was okay. We had broken up. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? There was another pressing issue which had to be sorted out immediately, and that was my trip to Italy to see the Red Hot Chili Peppers. When I made the bookings in February, I was still with Gloria, and so the air tickets had been booked in her name. I had told Debbie about the trip, and she was excited about going. She had also learned to enjoy their music during our previous relationship. In fact, Debbie bought me my first music DVD, a live Red Hot Chili Peppers performance. She had never travelled overseas before, so that was exciting for her as well. She didn't have a passport, so had to apply for an urgent temporary passport. I managed to get all the flight bookings and reservations changed in time, and we were all set to go. Things were going reasonably well between us, or so it seemed. We were not fighting or arguing as much, but all that was happening was she was behaving as she always had. However, I was not being confrontational. I would let her do or say what she wanted to, and I behaved in a tolerant and understanding manner. In her mind, things were fine, but in mine, I was wondering whether she was learning anything from her behavior and how much longer I could cope with my own approach. She was trying, though. I could see it, and that was important to me. As long as she was trying, then I would stay positive and committed. I never undertook my new relationship with Debbie as a task or a duty. Not consciously, anyway. I did love her, and I wanted to help her. If I hadn't loved her so deeply, then I don't know how long I could have carried on. The two things that were very important to her, which had resulted in her ending the relationship, still had to be dealt with: living together and marriage. She was still insecure about me, my commitment to her, my love for her, how I could have loved Gloria and then be back with her just a few months later. She's never been able to understand that Gloria was an incredibly important part of my life, of my spiritual awakening, and that it was God's plan that we had met, loved each other, and learned from each other. If that hadn't happened, I don't believe I would ever have been able to understand Debbie and the challenges of her journey. I doubt I would have wanted to try again, even though I loved her. I would never have been able to understand her sudden, irrational behavior. As far as living together was concerned, it was only a short few months before that I'd had issues in my space and my home. Then Gloria was suddenly part of my life, and I was forced to change my selfish ways. I had taken Gloria and her boys in because of circumstances, because she was facing eviction. It was perhaps God's way of preparing me for what I knew I had to do, to ask Debbie to move in. Brett and Shayna weren't too excited about having her two boys, but they accepted what I believed my journey to be and what I needed to do. I made the decision to ask her to move in when we got back from Italy towards the end of June. I also felt that I was truly committed to helping her. Given that I did love her, then I must remove my self-imposed obstacle of marriage. Having been married twice already, it was not important for me to be married. I had no problem being in a long-term, committed, happy relationship. I would have loved that. But Debbie had never been married, and she had these fairy tale views of what it should be like. To me, it was the only way that I could really prove to her that I was committed for the long term, that it would give her that sense of security she needed. I spoke to her mom about getting engaged when we were in Italy, and, well, Pat was excited about the idea. I asked her if there was any particular design for an engagement ring that Debbie might like, and there was. Pat managed to get me a picture of a ring that Debbie had once shown her. So I went and bought a beautiful large diamond, which I took to a jeweller with the design. It was quite a rush, as we had only a few days before we left for Italy. The next challenge was how to conceal the ring as we flew out of Johannesburg International Airport. It was too risky leaving it in the luggage, so I had no choice but to keep it on me. I was concerned that the metal detectors might pick it up, and I'd be forced to show it, which would lose the surprise for Debbie, but fortunately, there were no problems. Our first step was the romantic city of Venice, so I made the decision to propose to her there. We checked into our hotel, and I managed to arrange a gondola trip at sunset. The brochure showed a couple in a gondola, so I had assumed that is what we were in for, and paid for two tickets. As we queued, it dawned on me that there were at least four other couples in the gondola. There was no way I was going to propose in front of, and almost on top of, three other couples. So I went to the manager and started negotiating a solution. For him, it was simple. Pay for the other six tickets, and I could have the gondola to myself. What choice did I have? I bought the other tickets, so off we went on our sunset gondola trip. The weather was perfect, the waters were calm, the setting couldn't have been better. At an appropriate time, I bent down on one knee and asked Debbie to marry me. She hadn't been expecting this at all and was stunned, so much so that it took her a while to comprehend and accept. She was elated with the ring. It was perfect. After the gondola trip, we went for a romantic dinner at one of the many superb restaurants on the canals. She was truly happy, and so was I. But unbeknown to both of us, the fun was about to begin. The next day we were having a lovely lunch in a cozy restaurant when, after a couple of glasses of wine, she became very upset and stormed off to the bathroom. I had absolutely no idea what had started this. Nothing had been said, and we were having a great time. I sat there quite embarrassed, as lots of people had noticed her little departure. When she eventually returned, she threw her engagement ring on the table, shouted at me saying that she did not want to marry me, and stormed out. We hadn't been engaged for more than 16 hours, and I'd had the ring thrown back at me. Besides being extremely embarrassed, I was confused. I had no idea what had caused this reaction. I called for the bill, and as I waited, I played back what had happened, trying desperately to remember if there was anything that had been said or done to prompt this. There was nothing. I paid the bill and left. I had no idea where she had gone, but assumed it was back to the hotel. That's if she knew how to navigate the windy, narrow cobbleways. I took a slow walk back and found her in the room crying. I was confused, irritated, and angry. But I managed to suppress my feelings and took her in my arms and held her without saying a word. After a short while, I asked her what was wrong. She explained that while she was sitting there in the restaurant, she remembered the time when she'd burst into my bedroom to find me with Gloria, that she couldn't understand how I could have done that to her. So we were back to her silly interpretation of me cheating on her again. She said she'd always wanted to live with me, but I'd never bothered to ask her to. Yet I'd been quite happy to ask Gloria to move in after a couple of weeks. Now I've proposed to her, and she knows that I'm only doing this because I feel so guilty. I couldn't believe that she'd taken all these issues and come to such a ridiculous conclusion. I decided not to rationalize or explain to her that there was no logic to what she was saying. I told her that I loved her, wanted to be with her, wanted to marry her, and while I was doing this, I put the ring back on her finger. All was fine again, for a short while, that is. The next day, I was once again the recipient of the hurled engagement ring for the ridiculously obscure reason that I had originally planned the trip with Gloria, but now that she was no longer in the picture, I'd been forced to take Debbie. Such incidents happened a few more times throughout our holiday. What had started out as a romantic holiday turned out to be a roller coaster ride, a day or two of fun, followed by a day or two of hell. Sometimes she reacted after she'd had a drink or two, sometimes she was absolutely sober. I've been guilty of many things in my relationship. I'm not an easy person to live with. I have a quick mind with a sharp tongue to match. I'm selfish. I do not suffer fools gladly. I am intolerant of irrational and emotional behavior. I have a jealous side. I am a stickler for detail, and I have an amazing memory of what happened and what was said verbatim, and I like things to be done my way. Besides this, I'm actually easy to get along with. That was all before my spiritual awakening. The new me did not behave like that. Well, not always. I've never tried so hard to overcome these little design flaws I was born with as I did when I was with Debbie. I was so tolerant, so understanding, so flexible, so gentle. In fact, I went to extremes, which was not ideal. All it proved to me at that time was that I was not the cause of Debbie's problems. It was her and her inner conflict. In a way, it was a current déjà vu experience, as I'd seen the same type of behavior after I'd got engaged to Zelda. In my mind, the real issue wasn't whether I was committed to them or not. Perhaps at first they saw it like that, but once I'd given them the commitment they wanted, they realized it was something else, but weren't quite sure what it was. A simple analogy can be found in a sales environment when you try and close the deal and ask the customer for the order. Quite often, an objection is raised by the customer, so you address the objection in a satisfactory manner and attempt to close again. But yet another objection is raised. The cycle repeats itself until such time that you eventually get to the true objection, the real issue. In Debbie's case, now that she was able to have what she'd always wanted, she felt she was not deserving of it. She felt she was not good enough. The core issue, though, was that she did not like or love herself. To me, this explained her attempted suicide when she was a teenager and the self-mutilation scars on her arms. When I could recognize and understand her dilemma, I tried in my own way to tell her that until such time as she was able to love herself, it would be difficult for her to be loved and feel loved by someone else. What she needed was professional help, and so I insisted that she start this when we got home. But still, the highlight of the trip for me was watching the Red Hot Chili Peppers perform live. The San Siro Stadium was packed to capacity with at least 66,000 people. We were standing on the field about 50 meters from the stage. The energy that the band put into the performance can only be adequately described as absolutely awesome, something that I will never forget. But the Red Hot Chili Peppers concert was the catalyst for yet another challenge in my life, one that revolved around Stephen, who was 10 at the time. But I will go into this later. We returned home and Debbie moved in. Before we left, we had redecorated our bedroom, so we had new furniture, a new bed, and new curtains. The kitchen had been demolished and a new one built. There were a number of other rooms that were redecorated as well, so it felt like a new environment. A short while after we'd been back, Debbie started to investigate possible venues for the wedding. I couldn't understand how she could be doing this, as she was still ending our engagement every other day. It was so bad that half the time I didn't know if we were engaged or not. For that very reason, I wasn't supportive of her efforts. I felt that we should first build a stable relationship before worrying about setting a date to get married. Of course, this was then used against me, as she'd now decided that I didn't want to get married. In a dispute with a woman, or in my case, a very emotional woman, logic does not always work. So, how do you defend against this? Once, when she asked me why I'd got engaged to her, I said it was to show her that I loved her, that I was committed to her for the long term, and to give her the security of knowing that I was serious about it. The use of the word security in the middle of that sentence came back to haunt me time and time again. She decided that I'd got engaged only to give her security. Her view on this has never changed, despite hundreds of attempts by me to make her understand that I did not say it that way. Debbie sought help and managed to find a psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Trevor Modlin, who specialized in medical hypnoanalysis to deal with the subconscious mind. To us mere mortals, it means he uses hypnosis. He's well known in medical circles and has published several books on the subject. She decided to see him and, as these consultations were not covered by medical aid, I paid for them. After her first consultation at the beginning of July 2004, I asked her what he had diagnosed or suggested, and, surprise, surprise, he told her that she needed to deal with rejection. She was comfortable with him, so she decided that she would see him every Saturday morning for an hour. I was interested in the process, and, as I'm naturally curious, I wanted to know what they had done and what they were achieving. Debbie would never explain anything to me and got upset when I asked. I backed off and tried to find out from her mother, as Debbie always confided in her, but I didn't gather much there either. After a couple of sessions, I was asked to attend a session with her, where he tried to explain the process to me and typically how I should react when Debbie lost it. He explained her fight-or-flight behavior. I was expected not to confront her, but to back off. That was all good and well, but for how long do I have to back off? When exactly would things begin to change and some improvements be seen? It would take some time, was his response, probably up to 16 sessions. It made sense to me, to a degree, but perhaps I was being impatient. If she knew what she was doing, when would she change? It was like watching a spoiled child misbehaving and being tolerant of such behavior indefinitely. That didn't work for me, but I was trying. These sessions were very expensive, and so I expected some results. Eventually, after about 10 sessions, I asked her to explain what she'd understood thus far into the therapy. Her response was that she understood everything, but couldn't explain it. I have a simple belief. If you can't explain something, then you do not understand it. I told her it was all costing me a lot of money, and if she felt she wasn't benefiting, then we should try something else. That was just the excuse she needed. She stopped seeing him in October 2004, using the excuse that I'd said it was too expensive. I don't know how many times I'd tried to remind her exactly what I'd said, but she'd found a way out. My belief was that he was starting to make progress and getting close to her real issues, but that she was uncomfortable with this and had chosen flight. Earlier I mentioned that the Red Hot Chili Peppers concert was the catalyst for a challenge that I faced with Stephen. A few months before, I had managed to get the tickets. I'd made a comment to Stephen while we were watching a live performance of the band on DVD, and I said that one day I would take him to one of their concerts. When I did eventually get tickets, I didn't even consider him, as he was at school at the time. He seemed a little upset, but not overly so. When I phoned him from Italy, he was offish and told me he was upset that I had not taken him. I apologized and explained that the concert was during school term, but he was still upset. When we got home, he refused to speak to me on the phone, and When he did answer, he'd put the phone down. This was totally unacceptable behaviour, so I spoke to Annie about it, but in her typical stuff-you attitude that she'd honed into an art form, she said this was an issue between Stephen and me and she didn't want to get involved. This was equally unacceptable behaviour from her, so I wrote her an email where I said that her attitude was poor and there was no way that I would ever allow Stephen or Jamie to behave like that towards her. In fact, if they did, I would give them a hiding and force them to speak to her. I also reminded her of the many, many occasions when she'd phoned me to ask me to dispense telephonic discipline to the kids when they were misbehaving or not listening to her. I'd always supported her, as parents have to support each other. Otherwise, the kids learn to divide and conquer very quickly. She sent an email reply saying she would try and speak to Stephen, but suggested that I come down and see him. I said I would, but only once we were on speaking terms again. Otherwise, it would become a precedent that if he wanted me down there, he'd refuse to speak to me and assume that I'd come running. That would never work for me. So until we resolved the issue by speaking to each other, I was not going down to see him. Eventually, after a week or two, I managed to speak to him as he answered the phone one day. Before he could put the phone down, I spoke to him in a very firm voice and told him he dare not put the phone down until we had spoken properly. Perhaps it was the tone of my voice, or maybe he wanted to speak to me, but he listened. I explained that his behaviour was not acceptable, because no matter how upset he was with me, I was still his father, and I loved him, and nobody deserves not to be heard. The conversation that followed scared me. But it did not surprise me, because I knew this sort of stuff had been happening for a very long time. I asked him, "Stevie, why are you so upset with me?" "Because you lied to us," he replied. "What do you mean?" "You left us, you abandoned us, you don't love us." "No, Stevie, I never abandoned you, and of course I love you, and Jamie. I love you both very much."
"You did abandon us for someone else. Marriage is supposed to last forever."
"Who told you that?"
"My mother told me."
I had never said a bad word about Annie to them. There were many times that she had done things and deserved to be castigated, but I didn't. I never put the kids in the middle, as it was unfair to them. This time, I had to say something. "Stephen, did your mom not tell you that I was married to Brett and Shayna's mom when I met her? And your mom was happy I left Brett and Shayna's mom so that I could be with her? I'm also glad I did that, because that's why I have two beautiful boys in you and Jamie."
"I don't care. I wish I'd never been born," was his reply.
"Stevie, don't ever say that. I love you and Jamie, and I only left because I didn't want to be with your mom anymore. I left because we were fighting often, and it's not nice for kids to grow up in a home where the parents are always fighting. We both love you, and Jamie, but we don't love each other anymore." I was so upset after the conversation. I was tired of how Annie had messed with Stephen's mind so much. She's an intelligent woman, but sometimes a selfish and ignorant one. She knew what she was doing every time she badmouthed me to the kids, which was often. She knew the harm it was doing, but it didn't stop her. I spoke to her the next day, and we agreed she should take Stephen for counselling, because there was a lot of anger and hurt that he was still trying to deal with. She eventually got him to see a female psychologist who specialised with children, and after a couple of sessions, I was invited to meet with her. Sharon is a wonderful person, her only interest being the child she's dealing with at the time. We had a long chat, and I told her that Stephen would also have to learn to deal with rejection. She asked how I knew this, so I told her my story. She's a spiritual person and was comfortable with my views and experiences. I also explained much about my time with Annie and the things she had done that had affected Stephen since I'd left her. I also told her that Annie was adamant that Stephen go to boarding school, as Annie had been to a boarding school. But I didn't agree, and being responsible for the school fees, I refused to permit this unless I thought it in Stephen's best interests, which I knew it was not. Sharon told me that Stephen was crying out for a relationship with me, and that she would do what was necessary to make sure that it happened, and that I should let her deal with Annie. I left there comforted. I knew she would be a great help to Stephen. A couple of weeks later, after Sharon had had a few sessions with Stephen, she requested a meeting with Annie and me. It was a very interesting meeting, and I kept quiet for as long as was necessary. I watched how Sharon managed to get Annie to admit to all the negative things she was doing in relation to Stephen. Annie said that she had regularly said negative things about me, and Sharon explained how this made Stephen feel guilty for having fun when he was with me. He felt he was betraying her by enjoying being with me. She also said, categorically, that he felt rejected, and the worst thing she could do was to put Stephen into a boarding school. Over time, Stephen became more confident and happier now that he knew that he was allowed to enjoy himself with me, and he didn't feel guilty about betraying his mother in doing so. Lessons learned. 98. As a divorced parent, be very careful what you say to your children about your former spouse. It is how you choose to behave that will influence the quality of the relationship between your children and you or your former spouse. 99. Never make your children the go-between or put them in a situation that creates divided loyalties. 100. Every child carries some guilt, hurt, or anger as a result of a divorce, so never assume that they are okay just because they seem to be behaving in a normal way. Try and communicate with them so that they have the opportunity to express their feelings and concerns. If necessary, call in the help of a qualified professional to assist you and the children. Time passed fairly quickly, and before we knew it, it was the end of 2004. In December, Stephen and Jamie came to stay with me for a couple of days before I took Debbie and her boys down to San Lamia on the south coast of KwaZulu-Natal for Christmas, returned a couple of days before New Year. It had been an eventful year, far more than any other I could remember. The last year, 2003, had ended with Debbie breaking up with me, me meeting Gloria, Gloria moving in with me, my spiritual awakening, Gloria and I ending our relationship, Gloria moving out, my getting back together with Debbie, an overseas holiday, getting engaged to Debbie, Debbie moving in, some house renovations, drama with Stephen, leaving DocuNet and starting a new business. It had been a very challenging year. In January 2005, Trevor started proper school, and Debbie had ambitions of studying, so she signed up for a marketing diploma through correspondence. At the time, I tried to make her aware of the time and effort required to do this, in addition to holding down her job and being a mother. She wasn't happy in her job, as she was not being sufficiently stimulated. Her work was mundane, and she was not very happy working with her extremely moody boss. She left home every day at about 6:30 to drop off Trevor at school, and then travelled to the East Rand to her job. I dropped Callum off at nursery school each morning. The traffic frustrated her immensely. She got so irritated and worked up, both to and from work. It didn't take much for her to get worked up. She would leave work in a great mood, but by the time she had fetched the kids from school and got home, she would be in a foul mood. I can't say I blame her, as I hate sitting in traffic. There was a new dimension to her life now, Trevor's homework. If she wasn't already in a bad mood, then after 5 minutes of helping him with his homework, she would be. She just didn't have the patience for it, and she hated doing it. Often she'd end up shouting at him with Trevor in tears. By the time she'd finished supper and put the kids to bed, she was too tired to contemplate studying, and so it just never happened. Our relationship wasn't getting worse or better, for that matter. We still had lots of arguments, with her always ending the engagement and the relationship and wanting to move out. I had to be careful about what I and how I said things, which isn't always that easy, especially for me. In researching some of my archived material to write this book, I read through about 1,200 emails we had written to each other, and noting the dates, it was about every 3 days that we would be fighting like crazy, followed by a couple of days of loving peace. It was the simplest issues that set her off, as Debbie took everything absolutely personally. So it became impossible to communicate verbally with her. In fact, most of the time, I resorted to writing emails to her, because then she would at least get to hear or read what I had to say. Whenever we tried to discuss things, it would usually end up as a disaster. Debbie felt I had a way of speaking to her which set her off. I was oblivious to it. Whether it was my tone of voice or whether it was the words I used, I'm not sure. In verbal discussions, she would normally interrupt me, walk out, slam the door, throw a few picture frames around, or tear up photos of herself and us, or us together, and sometimes get in her car and drive away. Sometimes she would attack me physically by pinching, punching, or kicking me. She would lose total control, and in those moments she had no idea what she was doing and how to stop herself. It was like a whole new person had taken control. What made things very difficult for me was that Debbie was totally unperturbed about screaming, shouting, and arguing in front of her kids, my kids, or anyone else who happened to be around at the time. For me, this was an absolute no-no. I'm a private person and believe domestic squabbles should be addressed in private. My kids were old enough for it not to worry them too much, but you could literally see the effect on Trevor and Callum's faces when this happened. It hurt them, it confused them, and it unsettled them. At times I wasn't sure if I was helping or making things worse. I guess it was, well, a bit of both. It wasn't that I was trying to antagonize her, it was I didn't handle her outbursts in the best possible way. Sometimes I can be an intense person, and I hate loose ends. I find it difficult to accept vague, unresponsive answers to the simplest of questions. I guess I'm naturally a person who seeks accurate, unambiguous answers. So when I don't get them, I tend to adopt a real Perry Mason approach, and trust me, you don't want to be in the dock when I cross-examine you. I'm thorough, clever, and relentless in my pursuit for a simple, honest, direct answer. I guess that's what made me such a good interrogator back in my army days. Sadly, Debbie was a past master at giving, or should I say, not giving answers. It drove me crazy. At times, her approach made her seem guilty of something when she wasn't. When my Perry Mason persona took the floor, she hated it, as I drove her to answer simple questions step by step. So what should have taken 2 seconds to answer would take 3 minutes. She would naturally get defensive, and I would get frustrated. This is a typical example of what I'm referring to. On an occasion, she was going shopping. "Babes, what time do you think you might be back?" I asked. "Oh, I'm not sure, as I need to go to a few different shops." "I understand that, but do you think it'll take you 2, 3, or 4 hours? "I don't know, I have no idea how busy each shop will be." "Okay, babes, it's now 9 o'clock. At what time should I become concerned if you're not home? At 12, 2, or 4 o'clock? Or should I just not worry?" "I'll phone you when I'm finished to let you know." And in my mind, I'm going, "Ah!" All I needed was for her to say that it would take her about 3 hours. But if she was going to be longer, she would call and let me know. For at least the first 6 or 7 months, I was good at being very un-Kevin. That is, ignoring silly things, not responding to her tantrums, being loving without getting irritated and upset, and pretending nothing had happened. But I finally got to the point where I felt that this strategy wasn't working as things weren't improving. I felt that maybe Debbie thought she had carte blanche to continue in this manner. After all, it was a manner that had worked for her for the previous 28 years of her life with her mother and everyone else. So why should she change now? So I went back to being Kevin, You know, the confrontational, no-nonsense, I will not tolerate brats type of approach. This didn't work either, as Debbie now perceived me to be treating her like a child, which in fact was quite accurate, because at times her tantrums were leagues ahead of Callum's. As I reflect back on this period, I realize that I just wasn't capable of consistently finding the balance that was needed. If I'm angry, I need time to cool off and get my mind around what happened. If Debbie was angry, she could be back to normal as quick as you can switch on the light, wanting to be affectionate and loving. Call me a stubborn, stupid male, but I battled with this as I am clearly not as flexible. I would be okay in a few hours or the next day. Or to continue with the analogy, it was more like switching on a power station. It just takes a little longer. The types of issues that would set us on our path of argumentative frustration were things such as Gloria finding us in bed together, my financial support for her, allowing her to move in so quickly, getting involved with her so quickly after Debbie had broken up with me. Zelda, how I had met up with her during the time we had broken up in our first relationship. The fact that I wasn't prepared to commit to a wedding date. My kids being somewhat spoiled. The fact that they didn't respect or like her. The fact that they ate whatever was in the house, including the biscuits or sweets she had bought specifically for her kids. My domestic helper, Netto, who wasn't the hardest of workers, and in her opinion, wasn't too partial to her. Her kids being naughty and the fact that I was fairly strict with them. The fact that I was doing so much for them, but I felt that it wasn't appreciated. I would fetch and carry the kids, give them lots of time and affection. I did more for them than I'd done for my own. There were other issues as well, but the real problem was that these issues were never resolved in her mind, and so would pop up at any time, totally uninvited and unannounced. They were serial offenders, these issues. It was about March 2005 when I received one threat too many from her about moving out, that I agreed with her and insisted that she did. So before you could blink an eye, she'd moved out. Back to her mom. Her mom wasn't happy about this, as she was tired of having to look after them all, saying she couldn't afford it. Pat wanted her space, and I couldn't blame her. This didn't stop us from continuing our relationship. In my mind, it wasn't working, but in my gut, I knew it wasn't over. So I kept on trying as best I could. Not for a minute am I suggesting that my best was good enough, but I tried. We both loved each other and wanted it to work, but we just couldn't find the right formula. There were times when you could see she was trying very hard, but at other times when she was tired of trying, she simply resorted to her bad habits. She is the most generous person you could meet, giving her limited resources. She went out of her way to contribute financially in every way she could, more often than not beyond her means, which always got her into debt. She spent most of her spare money and bonuses on presents for me, which she would buy after a great deal of thought and planning. So over the next few months, we continued our on-off relationship. It was nice having some space and peace and quiet in the house. No screaming, crying kids. I guess this was the ideal solution for me, but it wasn't for her. And so we repeated the cycle all over again for a few months. Towards the end of September 2005, Debbie managed to find a female clinical psychologist by the name of Dr. Eliza. She has extensive experience in dealing with people who suffer similar symptoms to Debbie. After her first session with Eliza, I was asked to see her. I immediately felt comfortable with Eliza. She spoke about the work she did and the experience she had. She asked me about myself and why, after all this time, was I still in the relationship. I gave her my views and my spiritual understanding of my journey, outlining the role I believed I had to play in Debbie's life. She made quite sure that I was not only doing it for that, but also because I loved Debbie, which I really did, despite all the drama. As it turned out, Eliza is also a very spiritual person, and she recounted her spiritual path and experiences and what she understood her journey to be. Then we got back onto Debbie as she began to describe the various typical scenarios of how she'd behave in different circumstances. I was amazed as she was absolutely spot on. So I was convinced that Eliza understood what she had to do to help Debbie. Finally, someone understood the challenges that Debbie was facing and could explain them in a simple way that I knew Debbie could understand. I was meant to have spent an hour with Eliza, but I left there 2.5 hours later. Debbie was frantic. I'd left my phone on silent, but I did answer her calls during the session. She was anxious and, in her best defensive mode, wanted to know what we were discussing, what we were saying about her. Very little, in fact, as Eliza had only had one session with Debbie. I left the session in an upbeat, positive frame of mind. Debbie really took a liking to Eliza and seemed to be making good progress. This time I wasn't concerned about what they had achieved in each session, as I knew Eliza was in control. I let Debbie bring up the subject when she was comfortable with it. There was no overnight miracle cure, but Debbie was trying. And at times things progressed nicely, and we wouldn't get into silly arguments for a week or two. I really believed this was the breakthrough we so desperately sought. We moved in together again, more by default than design. I was terribly concerned about the constant upheaval for Trevor and Callum. Children need stability in their lives, not a regular process of moving home. At the same time, Debbie's mom was expecting her sister to move back from the UK to come and stay with her. The house wasn't big enough to accommodate her sister, her daughter, and her 2 grandchildren. No doubt, Debbie was under pressure from her mom. I was concerned about the impact on Brett and Shayna, as they were due to write their second-year final exams and A-levels, respectively. During one session I had with Eliza, I mentioned my concerns about Debbie and her kids moving in again, as Brett put in long hours of study and needed peace and quiet, something he had learned to enjoy over the past few months. Another issue was that Brett and Shayna had lost some respect for Debbie, as they had witnessed too many examples of her wild temper tantrums. They could not understand why I was still with her, but I kept telling them that I loved her and believed it was my role to help her. As it turned out, it wasn't an event, it was a process, and before anyone really knew it, we were living together again. In December 2004, we went to San Lemer over the Christmas period. Debbie wanted to go away in December 2005 as well, so during August we looked at several options. Because of the difficulties with Annie in getting Stephen and Jamie over school holidays, I was looking for a way to have my 2 young kids with us as well. We decided to go to San Lemer again. Debbie made the reservations and I was to pay the deposit. For some reason, I never got around to it. We were going through our daily trials and tribulations, and I supposed I was simply skeptical about whether we would still be together at the end of the year. So because I didn't pay the deposit, we lost the accommodation. This really upset Debbie, and rightly so. She felt that I wasn't prepared to do anything for her and her family. This wasn't true, but she had a right to be upset, as it was the only time in the year that she could take her kids on holiday, and I had created an expectation by agreeing to it. In October, I decided to rectify the situation, managed to find alternative accommodation at San Lemer. The plan was to take Shayna and her boyfriend, Brad, and fetch Stephen and Jamie on the way. We were going to be one big, happy family. We drove down to San Lemer in 2 vehicles, Brad and Shayna in the buggy, and Debbie and her 2 boys with me in the car. We stopped in Durban to fetch Stephen and Jamie, and, surprise, surprise, Annie had convinced Jamie that it wasn't a good idea for him to go. She'd reminded him continually how he'd struggled to be away from her for such a long time. I told him I'd bring him back whenever he wanted, even after a couple of days, but Annie's sway was too great, and so he stayed behind. Unfortunately, we had many arguments on holiday. Debbie was stressed, frustrated, and extremely moody. Her kids were irritating her, the weather was lousy, and to top it all, the unit that we'd rented was dirty when we arrived. Now, Debbie is quite fussy about having a spotless environment, and our unit was far from spotless. A perfect setting for all hell to break loose, which it did. I'd feared her emotional outbursts might take place in front of Stephen. I didn't want him to witness them, but they happened nonetheless for silly, stupid reasons. Once Shayna and Brad witnessed her suddenly shouting at me for no apparent reason as I was sitting alone on the couch. The more she performed, the more I withdrew. She perceived this as ignoring her, which only made things worse. We were back to the light switch analogy. She would take her two boys and disappear, sometimes in the bucky, sometimes goodness knows where. We had become two separate families, feuding families. On the first blow-up, she demanded that I fly her and her two boys back home. I told her to stop being ridiculous. The next time she demanded it, I told her to go ahead and organize the flights. She also demanded my credit card, which I gave her. She said she'd be moved out of the house by the time the rest of us got back from holiday the following week. We went off to play mashie golf for an hour, and when I returned, I found my credit card cut up into little pieces on the bed. No flights had been booked. The next day, she lost it again and started packing their suitcases. I called her to the room to reason with her, as she was in a fury. The next thing, she picked up the glass and cane bedside table and hurled it against the bedroom wall, spraying glass shards all over the room. That was the final straw. In my gut, I suddenly knew that our journey together was over. I couldn't continue with this any longer. I had subjected myself, my older kids, and now Stephen, to too much drama. I went downstairs and made the flight reservations for Debbie and her two boys for the next day. Debbie phoned Eliza, who was on holiday in the Kruger Park at the time, and spent some time chatting to her. A little later, Eliza phoned me. I told her what had happened and that I could not continue the relationship. Eliza said she'd been concerned about the family holiday as she wasn't sure that Debbie was ready for it. She asked me to remain calm and not to respond in a negative way, no matter how Debbie reacted. The next morning, 21st of December 2005, I packed the car and we left for the airport. I never said a word in the car. Debbie was crying and telling her boys that I'd never loved her or them and that I was chasing them away. I bit my tongue. It was stressful enough for the boys. She began to hit me while I was driving, but I ignored her. She tried to open up her door and jump out at about 130 kph. But I managed to grab her. I told her she was setting a bad example for the boys, that they were terrified and did not deserve to witness such behavior. It took a little over an hour to get to the airport, where I collected and paid for the tickets, gave her some cash to pay for a taxi from Johannesburg Airport back home, said goodbye to her and the boys, and left. I was hurting, hurting for her, hurting for her kids, and hurting for myself. I knew we had gone a bridge too far. I returned to San Lemire, and we tried to make the most of the rest of our holiday, but everyone's mood had been dampened. The next day, I had to take Stephen back to his mom. In the car, I tried to explain to him what Debbie had to deal with, and he shouldn't judge her for her behavior. I know I managed to get through to him and asked him not to tell his mom about what had happened. It was the first time that I had ever asked him to do this, but I didn't want Annie to try and use this episode against me the next time I wanted to have Stephen for the holidays. Sadly, Stephen didn't keep the secret, but I only found this out a couple of months later. We spent Christmas Day with Dario and his two daughters and drove back home on the 27th of December 2005. When we got home, Debbie was still there. She said she had nowhere to go, as she couldn't move back to her mom's house, as her aunt was now staying there, and she didn't have the money to rent an apartment. I'd been in this situation before, not too long ago, hadn't I? She was looking for a place to stay, but this was not the best time of the year to find decent accommodation. I agreed that she could keep the engagement ring, which she could sell. In the meantime, she stayed in my house, sharing a room with her boys. It was uncomfortable for everyone, but we somehow got through it. For New Year's Eve, we had prior plans to attend a musical show at the Barnyard Theatre with Debbie's mom and aunt and a few friends. But despite Debbie asking me to join them, I just couldn't. I was very down, unhappy, and frustrated. I just wasn't good company. So I stayed at home on my own. At about 9 o'clock, I received a call from Sandra, Debbie's aunt, to come and join them, but I politely declined. By 10 o'clock, I was in bed on New Year's Eve, something I had never done before. Was I really becoming an old and lonely 44-year-old? Debbie found an apartment at the end of the first week in January. I went with her to see it, and it was ideal. The ring would take a while to sell, so I decided to give her the equivalent value of the ring in cash. I paid her first month's rent and the deposit, went with her to buy a bed, washing machine, and fridge, and paid the balance into her account. I helped her move and even spent time setting up her new television and hi-fi system. It was a difficult time for both of us, as we still loved each other and were both hurting. The emotional roller coaster was still going strong. One minute, she would be friendly and easygoing, and the next, when she was hurting, angry and difficult. She felt I had broken my word. I had told her that I was going to see this through with her, which I believed at the time. She felt I hadn't and that I should persevere. But I just couldn't anymore. I had stuck it out for 20 months since we'd got back together again on the 17th of April, 2004. I didn't believe I was helping her anymore, as we had slipped into the habit stage, when the habits become cyclical. I couldn't see a positive future. I was tired. I was defeated. But I still loved her. I knew she was a good, generous, genuine person. But she had this inability to control her anger and emotions. I often wished I didn't love her. It would have made things easier to deal with. Over the next few weeks, we continued to see each other on and off, as neither of us really wanted to meet anyone else. We had always enjoyed a fantastic sexual relationship, which was the thread that kind of kept us together at that time. Even though I still loved her, I knew I couldn't give her what she wanted, which was simply for me to marry her and be with her forever. I made that clear when we saw each other. I couldn't commit to marriage in such an unstable relationship. Perhaps if I hadn't been married twice before, I might have considered taking a risk in doing so, but I didn't ever want to go through another divorce. At first, Debbie felt she could handle a casual relationship with me, and selfishly, I was prepared to try it with her. But it didn't take long for me to realize what I already knew. She couldn't. Eventually, at the beginning of March, I did what I should have done several weeks before, to permanently end any type of relationship with her. I regret that I hadn't done it sooner, as it was unfair of me to continue to see her in any form of relationship, because, for her, it was giving her hope that maybe, just maybe, there might be a chance we'd get together again.